Welcome to our podcast at agendadigitale.eu.
So welcome to the Secure in Mind podcast, where Nick Kelly and Alessandro Longo discuss the ins and outs of technology, security, cybersecurity, privacy, artificial intelligence, their broad impact on society, and why we really need to care and be invested in the development of those technologies if we want humankind or humanity to move forward. Anyway, today's special guest is a fantastic representative of an international organization, United Nations, and his name is Neil Walsh. We're very honored to have him here. And we'll be discussing what he does at the United Nations and how the United Nations helps to empower different country policing units, etc., in the fight against cybercrime, amongst a range of other things. So welcome, Neil.
Nick, thank you very much for having me on the podcast. I appreciate it.
I'm really looking forward to this chat. I've had a fair bit of experience, not nearly as much as you have, but working in and out of emerging markets and alongside and into organisations like United Nations, etc., through in Guatemala. Really looking forward to having this chat. So I guess to set the scene, I'd like to ask some general questions about you, your background. Again, this podcast is focused on getting the person who may or may not have an interest in security to at least up their game so that they understand why they should care. So sure. Maybe let's go back to what got you to care about security. So we'll walk through your background and how you came to be where you are.
All right. What got me to care about security? I think the main thing is I grew up in Belfast in Northern Ireland in the 80s and the 90s, and Northern Ireland at that time, really from the 60s through until the early 2000s, had a significant terrorism problem. And a number of occasions for me as a kid growing up and seeing this happening in the city, in the country that I lived in, where there were routine shootings, where there were routine bombings. It's an occasion when I was 13, I remember it as clear as day, standing in a clothes shop with my dad on a Saturday morning in the middle of Belfast. And I guess I felt the shockwave before I heard anything. Wow. And the windows of this shop came in around me, and the noise was phenomenal. And I remember sort of stumbling out into the street with my dad, people lying dead and dying in the street. Wow. And you know, bits of bodies and stuff lying across the place, and smoke in the air, and unable to hear because of that impact on my hearing. And That was a really defining moment for me, because you see stuff in the news, it's impactful, but the moment you actually experience in real life, that was the moment for me where I thought, all right, time to do what I can to do something about this. I didn't really know as a 13-year-old what that was going to be, but that was the start for me.
Wow. It's such an impactful, visceral experience. Things off. Do you, I guess, jumping forward a bit, do you find in some areas like of life and cyber as well, that sometimes, sadly, it does take that really rude shock to the system, the rude awakening, to actually jolt you into action or jolt you into caring? Otherwise, apathy prevails.
I think there's certainly an element of that, Nick, where that can be consistent across government, across private sector, across day-to-day life, where often, despite there being risk in the world or in a society, we don't sometimes see change until something has either gone horribly wrong or come very close to that happening. So it often takes something, and that's especially true for the UN, which is an organization based out of the Second World War, that something often has to come very close to happening before change happens.
Yeah. Well, at least we're consistent in not learning our lesson.
You could say that. I couldn't possibly comment. My wife might say that most nights, but anyway, well, she won't listen to this, hopefully. If she does, I'm sorry.
Well, you got it there. It's a clear apology on her. All right, so let's go back to, you know, after the extremely horrible event that you you experienced and witnessed. Fast forward to, I guess, when you're sort of in your formative years, university. I was reading a bit of a bio about you, and that's kind of where really, you know, things moved into more of a policing element or an interest in law enforcement, at least.
Yeah, certainly. As I sort of went through school, I went to a school called St. Malachy's College in Belfast, and my plan had been to be a doctor, but turns out that plant biology, which was in my last exam, wasn't my forte. So when the results of that came through, medicine sort of dropped off the radar because I wasn't able to label the reproductive parts of a plant. So the backup then had been psychology and criminology at the University of Teesside in the northeast of England.
A natural backup for plant, you know, plant and
that. Yeah, that's not even into that space. But it was, you know, some really good careers advice from a teacher called Jim McDonald, who sort of stuck in my head as, always have a backup, always have another plan. And so I went off to read psychology, criminology, really get into the subject, did a lot of studying on forensic psychology, offender profiling, serial sexual offenders, and had, you know, a really empowering dissertation supervisor that brought me down the path when I wanted to study policing and the personality profiling of cops who carry firearms through choice. Wow. And it really just led me on to applying to join law enforcement and kind of went from there.
Okay. And then during that time, I think you worked with the FBI, didn't you?
Yeah, so I graduated with sort of my psychology criminology degree and joined what was then called the National Criminal Intelligence Service in London, which was the intelligence part of national policing. So there was a sister agency called the National Crime Squad, and then over the next couple of years they merged to become the Serious Organised Crime Agency, and then a couple of years back became the National Crime Agency. So way back when I started, which was just coming to the end of 2000, I was working primarily on counter-narcotics, and then September 11th happened. Wow. And lots of refocusing on counter-terrorism effort across UK policing and international policing. And I ended up working on the September 11th investigation and investigations that came out of that into terrorists and weapons traffickers and that sort of thing, which had me in and out of New York really over the next couple of years.
Wow. How was that experience? So was it a drastic difference between how the FBI conducted their operations and in Ireland, or I guess was it a bit of a mess after the 9/11 event?
I wouldn't say it was a mess. I would say that I think that it really was the focus after 9/11 of a country that had come under a sustained, almost unthinkable attack. And the sheer scale of loss of life and the way in which it was done, the impact that can have was remarkable. And I and my organization, the National Crime Squad, we became part of a thing called the Joint Terrorism Task Force, which it's really the first time the U.S. infrastructure brought together the FBI, Homeland Security, Immigration and Customs, NYPD for New York, and really trying to get this multi-agency focus on a thematic risk. And it really helped us to work internationally much, much better than we probably would have done in the past. But you know, as we said at the start, Nick, a lot of this is something bad happens, and that refocuses the mind on how we do things better.
In a way, so okay, so effectively, that's that started off the career in policing, and when progressing through the policing side, which areas did you work in? Did you work basically across the spectrum, and how did that career progress?
So really staying on the counterterrorism side through to 2002, then moving into anti-kidnap and anti-corruption work. So looking at internal corruption within our organisation, looking at corruption within different bits of the police service in the UK. And then I was lucky to move into really starting off the UK response to human trafficking and human smuggling. and focusing very much on human trafficking for sexual exploitation, which is a very, very high risk area. And then over the next number of years, really moving into covert policing. So looking at bringing covert techniques across counter-narcotics, counter-kidnap response, and managing a lot of threat to life and high-risk sides of the business. I was then lucky enough to be promoted and selected to go overseas. So I was based in The Hague, representing the UK at Europol, the EU's law enforcement agency, between 2010 and 2015. And then moved from The Hague to Malta, which was going to be a four-year plan to do counter-immigration work and linking into other organized crime that was either impacting on Malta or hitting the EU from Northern Africa through Malta or linked to Malta. But in that period of time, I'd seen a vacancy at the UN that I applied for at the UN Office on Drugs and Crime. And lo and behold, was offered that job towards the end of 2015. So having moved my wife and four kids through four countries in 4 months in 2015, we ended up in Vienna. And I don't recommend doing that to anybody. Do not move country four times in 4 months. It doesn't help anybody out.
No, with four kids as well in tow. But I guess you've landed in a beautiful place. So.
We certainly did. We've been lucky. We've served in two really great places, and now to end up in Vienna, we've been here for 2.5 years now. It's it's a remarkable privilege, and I'd always had a fantasy as a kid of working for the UN without really understanding what it was or what it did. And now to be in that and in a relatively good leadership position to change the business, to refocus the business and really have impact, it's a hell of a privilege. And I realize that there are many, many people would love to get to do my job. So it's part of the drive behind it, is that you really got to do what you can to have an impact, because there's plenty of people out there that would expect that we do that.
Exactly. And look, we'll definitely do a bit more of a focus on the United Nations and some of the pros and cons of working in such a big bureaucratic system and how you tackle that and how you can change that. But
sure.
if we jump back to, you mentioned these specific areas of policing, which are quite fascinating to people, but they may not understand exactly what the job entails. So, for example, when you mentioned counter-terrorism, what exactly do you do as a counter-terrorist specialist? Does it involve a huge amount of research? Are you pouring through documents? Are you making contacts on the street? Are you doing more and more cyber investigation? How does that work?
It's like many things. It's a broad title, and there are a multitude of roles, like across law enforcement, that you could be working in counter-terrorism, counter-narcotics, whatever.
Yeah.
All of this, and looking at the criminal justice system as a whole, is being presented with a premise of what's going on, and then really getting into testing the hypotheses that you're presented with. So saying that person A may be a terrorist or a drugs trafficker or a weapons trafficker or whatever, and then the whole thing is about gathering evidence to either prove or disprove that fact. And the importance within that is everything that, certainly in my past as a cop that I did, and anything that we do now within the UN where we're training other cops and prosecutors, is you've got to let the evidence take you down that path. So not prejudge what's going on.
Mm.
Everything that we do must be proportionate. It must be legal, must be accountable, must be necessary. So it's the old adage of using a sledgehammer to crack a nut.
Yeah.
It's managing that intrusive aspect where maybe you're trying to gather telephone data on someone, like their dialing records or their internet history, right the way through to a wiretap or an undercover infiltration or surveillance. Lots of really intrusive things, and it's making sure that they're used at the right point, at the right time, for the right aim, and that there is robust oversight in that challenges your decision making, to make sure that you don't become into the same space that the criminals are doing. So it's about keeping society safe in a way that is proportionate and allows a free democratic society to continue.
Mm-hmm. And do you have an example of the rule, maybe not specifically from the counter-terrorism work, but say an interesting case that you were working on that involved the overlay of different areas, so for example sexual exploitation, human trafficking and potentially counter-terrorism, And as this podcast does focus on, I guess, the technical impact and aspect of the multitude of things that we do in our lives, maybe an example which kind of also draws in that cyber aspect, the technology forensic aspect, etc.
Sure, I'll give you a generic rather than focusing on a specific example, because there's always a risk that links into an old case.
Yeah, probably a good idea.
Let's look at the premise of if I look at how we live our lives now, Nick, compared to how it was maybe 10 or 15 years ago, Society has, at least it seems to me, fundamentally changed. The next time you sit on a train or on a bus, have a look at the people around you and see how many people are looking up. Yeah. Or how many people, and I would predict that the majority of people will be looking at a phone.
Yeah, and it's horrifying sometimes.
It's just different. I'm not going to stick the word horrifying on it because I'm as guilty as it is anybody else.
Ah, me too. but walking paradoxes, us humans.
Completely. There are a multitude of ironies and paradoxes throughout this that it's the really do as I say and not as I do. Mm. So let's look at what we're talking about here. And a lot of our mission now and the sort of thing that we're doing now by on a podcast is to really make this real for people to understand how crime and terrorism interact together, how they can impact across your lives.
Yeah.
And we all live our lives on our phones, whether it's an Android, an iPhone, whether you're on social media or not. I'm not on Facebook. I have no friends. If it was there, it would be an empty room of me talking to myself.
You don't exist.
But I realize, and that's down to having four kids under the age of eight. Mm. But it's looking at how do you live your life now? So how much do those of you who are listening to this, how much of your life do you put online? Mm. Thinking about why we do that. And this can take us into a really uncomfortable conversation sometimes as to why do people put so much of their lives online? And is it for that psychological feedback loop where you want to be feeling better because people are giving you likes? Mm. Is it that it's a way of feeling connected to people? Although when you get into those discussions of someone might have X number of thousands of followers or friends or connections on a social media package, but when you bring that back to real life, how many people you actually know, it gets into a really interesting discussion.
Yeah.
Start applying that to crime and terrorism. And if I think back to terrorists or criminals who I spoke with, either overtly or covertly, generally, they're relatively normal human beings a lot of the time, and that can be a big surprise for a lot of people. There isn't necessarily this stereotype. It's the same way you often see on media a picture of a generic cyber criminal is a white guy, probably early 20s, sitting with a hoodie on and the face in a shadow. It could be more wrong. It's a lazy stereotype to take. Yeah. And
that's great for marketing, though.
precisely, and that's all it is. It is principally a marketing tool, but it does grab the public consciousness.
Yeah.
But it's the irony that when one sits with a terrorist or a criminal, they look like you or me. It could be male, female, rich, poor. People are in it for a multitude of reasons, but the principal reason behind most criminal offending behavior, whether it's crime or terrorism, is profit. It's making money. And when you look now at how we live our lives, whether we live it in the midst of our electronic device, a lot of what happens there then bleeds into the criminal marketplace. And part of my role now is to advise the Secretary General in New York on what is the positioning of the UN and all these sorts of matters. Mm. And it seems to me that it's much easier sometimes that not to think about a theme, like not to think about terrorism or online child abuse or weapons trafficking. It's looking at a criminal business model. It's moving a commodity from A to Z. Mm. And criminals and terrorists are often much more flexible and responsive than policing or government ever will. They don't have standard operating procedures to follow. They don't have to follow the law. They don't have to follow budget cycles.
Yeah.
If they see an opportunity, and I saw this very, very clearly in my previous life, where you might have an organized crime group who was proficient at moving, let's say, moving drugs from A to B. Mm. But then the opportunity arose to move people. And then trying to balance that risk, looking at the risk-reward-profit side of it, that moving and trafficking people might be a hell of a lot more profitable than the risks involved in moving and trafficking drugs. the production was easier, getting access to people was easier, looking at the migration chain. And we often saw, and we continue to see, that people who are smuggled, so people who wish to be smuggled from a country to another country, are at really high risk of being trafficked as well. And being trafficked is where it is not a conscious thing that's going on. It is duplicity. So let's say you are trafficked, you're being offered an opportunity that doesn't turn out to be true. And I remember the first ever trafficking case that I was the senior investigating officer for a long time ago now, where two teenage girls were moving from a country in Eastern Europe to the UK, thinking that they were going to get jobs in a hotel or a restaurant in London. And the moment that they got off the plane in London, they had their passports taken by the organized facilitators who they thought were their friends. They were brutally raped in the airport car park and then trafficked within a number of different jurisdictions, a number of different towns and cities, and forced to work in off-street brothels. And the horrendous physical damage that these young girls went through over a very short period of time, really, that was the definition of trafficking, that it is covert, it is exploitative, you don't know what you're getting into, and what you think you're going to doesn't occur. Wow. And it is profit motivation behind all of this. And we see this now throughout the migration chain, where there is that risk that people willingly seeking to be moved from country A to B, often paying an enormous sum of money to do so, will then be trafficked en route. They may be trafficked for sexual exploitation. They may be trafficked for labor exploitation. So let's say you've agreed to pay $5,000 to move from A to B, which might have taken you 15 years to save up. And then on the route, in that supply chain, the organized criminal says, okay, well, that ain't happening now. The price has gone up, and here's what you're going to have to do to pay it off.
Yeah, because they always hold the cards and the leverage.
Absolutely, absolutely. The leverage is always on the other side, because you as an individual are engaging in a supply chain that is inherently risky.
Yeah.
And we can see that now. You might have heard of the dark net, the encrypted bit of the internet, where you can buy drugs, you can buy guns, you can buy cyber attack capability. There is a significant amount of online child sexual abuse material out there. For example, there are darknet sites that specialize in the live streaming rape and sexual torture of pre-verbal children of around 6 months old. And that this is all on pay-per-view streaming. And there are hundreds of thousands of people who view this stuff. This is not a small amount.
That's incredible, isn't it?
A lot of the research now, there's some really interesting criminological research being done by the U.S. Marshals Service, a guy called Dr. Mike Burke, based in Washington area. And Mike's research is starting to point at a percentage of adults who have asexual interest in children that could be anywhere between 4 and 10%, which is a frightening figure.
Of the population.
Correct. Yeah. And what we can take from that is that we all know a paedophile. We just don't know who they are. And that the risk around this is that there is often some stereotypes and predispositions put on it, that a paedophile might be an older single man with there's a stereotype that occurs, but it is not the case. It could be you, it could be me, it could be a female sexual offender as well. Paedophiles as well as men, albeit that statistically much, much less. But we have certainly seen casework where women, for example, have been violating children in creche and nursery school, videoing that and then selling that for profit. So,
and as a profiler, I guess, what are the kind of differences in the mentality, given your previous work as a profiler?
So there's a, and just to be clear, I was never a profiler. I studied it, but I never went on to specialize in that. There are some, like Mike Burke, who I mentioned, another chap called Dr. Joe Sullivan. They're two of the leading sexual offender profilers out there dealing with paedophiles. So you look at paedophiles are typically those who get sexual gratification from children who have not started puberty. And then you have hebephiles, who are interested in children who are pubescent but below the age of consent. And it's looking at sex offenders as a term. It's kind of like saying cancer. There's lots of different types in lots of different spaces, and there are different motivations behind it. So we see sex offenders who are sadistic, who are the worst, the most dangerous end of that scale, who their whole gratification is to cause pain, and their arousal mechanism is on that pain and that torture, right the way through to those who seem to feel that there is a genuine connection or love with a child. So there are different ways of assessing that, and then that gives you a different, really a different way of investigating it and gathering the evidence about that, and then trying to look at, well, what do you do about that person once they are in prison? So can they be rehabilitated, or is there an ongoing risk that is going to be exceptionally difficult to manage?
And pulling it back into the technology theme of the podcast, how do you apprehend that person if they're hiding behind the anonymization tool of darknet?
It's a really good question, and there is no easy answer. The encryption provided by the darknet and by virtual private networks is exceptionally difficult for law enforcers to have to deal with. Is the counter side of that is that these techniques enable privacy as well, and that's why my sense of things is that there is not one easy answer to this.
No, it undulates on both sides. You know, from a personal perspective, I'm a huge supporter of privacy, and I'm a supporter of movements like the Electronic Frontiers Foundation, and having lived in emerging markets, you can see the absolute necessity as an activist, in civil society, as a journalist, and there's, you know, sadly, that same tool which can liberate and which can spread ideas is also the crux of the criminal enterprise.
Correct, but that's like anything, right? So hates and kids run over in cars by drunk drivers, but the solution isn't to ban the car.
Exactly.
So it's really having perspective about this, but
out of interest in think tanks that you're involved in, what are sort of different solutions that you're looking at? So let's take the car example. Obviously, the car has gone through multiple iterations since the first T model, with seat belts, airbags, side seat belts, reinforced, crumpling hoods, and blah blah blah. What sort of where are we at now, and what kind of things are we doing to bolt on, or are we thinking at your level, are you completely thinking of revamping?
I think there's some really nice. This is where, this is not a law enforcement solution. Policing criminal justice system is not the solution to cyber dependent crime like online child abuse, cyber enabled crime like online child abuse, or cyber dependent crime like making malware and sharing it. This happens to be the mechanism for sharing it, right? But I think simply trying to attack the mechanism for doing that misses the point. Behind it. So back to looking at it as a criminal business model, and speaking to criminals and terrorists, the thing that often undermined them and had the biggest impact, it certainly wasn't prison. Most organized criminals expected at some point to go to prison. It was an occupational hazard. Start taking their money off them, when you start taking their proceeds of their crime, restraining those assets, that really undermines their ability to do things. And that is a big part of what my department does now. So I run the cybercrime and anti-money laundering department within the UN Office on Drugs and Crime. Within that, we cover counter-financing of terrorism. We cover capacity building for sanctions evasion out of the Security Council. So lots of different bits of the business. And all of these, why we bring cyber and illicit financial flows together is they are the enablers of crime and terrorism.
You stop the incentive, I guess.
Say again, Nick?
So stop them and then you really hamper the incentive if they can't.
Yeah, you start to look, can you remove that profit from it? Because that is principally what the orientation is. You look at terrorists operating Middle East and North Africa, they are making significant profit from perhaps energy generation or movement of people. You look at the links between organized criminals and terrorists, where you may have organized criminals who are directly involved in the trafficking of weapons and ammunition, and terrorists are then using organized crime links to get access to those weapons. Or you look at, for example, using a darknet marketplace that's focused on one commodity, but then individuals penetrate that and start doing it for something else. But it's technology is part part of the problem, without doubt, but it is also part of the solution. And it's, like I said, there's too much of this to arrest your way out of. And that we really need, and part of the key bits of the work we're doing now is to partner much stronger with the tech sector and look at what does technology bring as a solution. What are the risks around it? We've seen, you know, recently the impact of the Facebook Cambridge Analytica scandal coming out, and the awareness that that has given, I think, in broader general public about the risks of social media that may not necessarily be true, or where the where accounts that may be fake or fictitious, and that the ability of those, the scale of those, to drive public opinion in democratic elections is exceptionally strong. Yep. So we need to work much, much closer with the private sector and those in the tech sector who are the developers of this to understand what they're trying to do. And there is a pressure on them, and rightly so, to have a social, corporate, ethical business model that counters risk. And they need to be cognizant of this risk before they bring a product to market, because trying to catch up with something once it's already out there is exceptionally difficult.
Yeah, and you know, I actually had a conversation, I can't remember, a couple of days ago with one of my previous guests about that supply chain issue and the economic incentive to build in security at the factory level. And we came up with a sort of anecdotal example of a Chinese manufacturer which is making cameras, and then it becomes the cameras have weak security. They become part of a botnet known as the Mirai botnet. Yep. But what's the incentive for that factory in China to make to shave off 1 cent of their 3 cents margin that they make on each camera in order to build better security at the firmware level? There's no incentive, and so until they have that financial incentive where it is worth their time to build in security, they'll just keep on pumping out shoddy products, which just floods the market, and there's nothing you can really do about that except bolt on. It's a very complex one to tackle.
It's really complex to tackle, and I'm not sure that it's simply China. I think there are multiple producers around the world, from east to west, where this is risked, because, like you said, it is profit motivation. And if your pressure from shareholders or a chief executive is to bring a product to market because it's going to sell, then security by design is unlikely to be up the top of your thought process. It mightn't even be in it at all.
Probably not.
As you say, you look at the risk from the Internet of Things, or as somebody defined it recently, the Internet of Threats, is that you've got all of these devices that are connected out there. And if we're having this conversation again in 2 or 3 years' time, it will have totally changed again.
Oh, yeah.
So how do we
call it, well, there's a rude, we call it the Internet of Cluster Beep. I think that's quite appropriate.
This is why having those links between private sector, government, between legislators and policymakers, that it has to happen. It has to be a part of the solution. The solution to this isn't having a load of diplomats and policymakers sitting in a room and talking about stuff where often we don't have the understanding to even make that decision.
Yeah.
You need to be the people who are designing it, working out where they can bring that in, and as you rightly say, what is the motivation to make security as a part of that process? How do we make that? How do you come up with a security architecture that's going to be acceptable internationally? I think that's exceptionally difficult, because there are different countries with different worldviews, with different perceptions of what security is. And what we need to be really careful of here, let me give you the example I talked about already on the darknet about child sexual abuse material. There is, and something, if I may, sometimes you hear someone will use the term child pornography, and that doesn't exist. And I ask everybody listening to this to help advocate for not using that term. Children aren't involved in pornography, right? If you think of a child that you know, if that child was kidnapped today, raped on camera, and that was put online, you wouldn't call them a porn star.
No.
Children aren't involved in porn, and it's really important, because if we... The nuance of the language matters in this, that victims are re-victimized by being accused of being involved in child porn. And there's a number of media providers that recently keep using that term, and I keep challenging them on it, that children are exploited and abused. So anybody, if they hear that, if they counter that and explain why, it's really important that it helps to stop re-victimizing victims.
Yeah.
So you look at the child abuse material that exists on the open internet, and there's still a large amount of it, often in news groups or on social media channels, then there are technological solutions out there to counter it. And we're working, for example, with a company called NetClean, and there's a charity called the Internet Watch Foundation, and they're bringing tech solutions to countering online child abuse. So, for example, they will get known IP addresses, so that sort of digital fingerprint of where a child abuse image or video is hosted, and then applying their techniques to internet service providers, you're able to block access to that material. And by blocking access to that material, you block the access for a child abuser to get access to it. Mm. Now, taking that a little bit further is by applying that to known child abuse material. And when I say it's known, it has been assessed by, for example, Interpol or law enforcement agencies who have then shared that amongst each other and defined what that abuse material is. It's then looked at within legislation. So, for example, the Internet Watch Foundation, they have reporting portals across the world. If you find child abuse material, you report it to them and they get it taken down very rapidly, and we're partnering with them on that. Mm. But by doing that, by using defined and objectively tested child abuse material against legislation, then you make sure that this capability doesn't allow a government to then start controlling bits of democracy. Because what we have to be really careful of is that by blocking access to child abuse material, that governments don't then say, aha, now we need to control the internet, and we need to control freedom of speech, and we need to control political democracy, and we need to control freedom of thought, and we need to control all of this infrastructure. So it's making sure that we have the right solution for the right problem at the right time. And as you can imagine, there are very, very different views in different parts of the world on what that might look like. And that's why by focusing on a crime type that is apolitical, that people from west to east care about and want to do something about, then we can focus on something that matters, and we can actually start to define this, and we can start to put some scale and objectivity around it about what's right to tackle online, what isn't. And then starting to look at what are those risks today, not just to children, but to adults as well. Mm. You might hear the European Commission comes out and talks about fake news as being a priority in the online space for the European Union. And if you look at that now, you look at the potential influence that social media has had, that disinformation has had, fake news and the potential for that to be produced, and the role of tech companies in doing that is phenomenal. And this is changing how society interacts. It changes how people speak to each other, and it changes how people make decisions. And that's why tech companies are a fundamental part of this solution and need to step up to that.
That's, I found a really interesting point that you mentioned about the crime type being, a unifying common denominator for different countries with different people, views and values. However, at their core, some of these, the horrific crimes which you're talking about, is almost a unifying point. And you leverage that and use that to say, right, we're on the same page on this one. Let's act as an international community or as a European community, etc.
Absolutely. And I was lucky enough to be speaking at an internet security summit in Beijing last year. I'd never been to China before, an audience of 8,000 people. And I went with my stereotypes, with my preconceptions about what I was going to hear, about understanding what cybercrime risk and threat looked like in China, and listening to their experts and their tech companies and their government and their policing infrastructure. It was no different to being at a conference in London and Washington and Auckland, wherever. It's primarily a financial-based risk of cyber criminals or cyber-enabled criminals doing stuff to harm economic prosperity. So either producing fake goods or undermining genuine legitimate business, and again with the other aspects of the child abuse side on that. So it's looking at those areas of consensus, those bits that we all agree on, and then let's do something about it.
Raises an interesting point about the mental default stereotype, because I guess it compartmentalizes and it simplifies a lot of our natural process in life. And you know, from an evolutionary standpoint, it's served us quite well, because then we can instantly classify as bad or good, etc. But then you realise it's completely bollocks. You're on the other side of the world, and sadly, obviously, the media does play a part in this as well, about tarnishing with a political brush, and that's and we can again use our logic and think, okay, it's just politics, but we do retain those stereotypes, and that plonk yourself in a conference, and it's like being in downtown LA or Australia or Malaysia or Timbuktu. It doesn't really, there's people with similar interests, yeah.
I mean, this is what we have to really focus on, Nick, that it's a bit Shakespearean, but, if you prick us, do we not bleed? We're all fundamentally trying to get on with life and have a quality of life that's as good as possible for us. Generally be decent people to each other. Try not to hurt each other along the way and not screw things up.
Yeah.
And we see that, generally human beings are like that. Then that's where my job, the job of my staff around the world, the UN generally, we ought to be about trying to bring people together. And that is what we're about. And our Secretary General in New York and my boss here, my executive director, it's about looking at what is our role in this. And it's not about being the be-all and end-all for everybody. That is not what it's about. Mm. But what we ought to be about is what can we do as a pretty big organization to help prevent all this stuff from happening or to minimize this. The whole point of the UN, it was formed just after the Second World War, is about prevention. It's about preventing global conflict and whatever that may be now. And the whole nature of that has changed. And the reason why cyber and the ability to move illicit finances through cryptocurrency is so relevant to this debate is because it's not simply about crime. We know, for example, and many of your listeners might have heard of the concept of advanced persistent threat groups, APTs, which are those highly specialist, technically proficient cyber criminal groups who also may act on or on behalf of nation states, on behalf of intelligence agencies or military or policing or government. And when you see that there are those highly adept technical skill sets out there that one moment might be undertaking a regular cyber crime based activity for financial profit, may then also for financial profit be doing something on behalf of a nation state to do, or they may give a weaponized cyber tool to a nation state to, for example, launch a global ransomware attack like we saw last year.
Yep.
Number of occasions. And then looking at, what is the generation of ransom there? What's it being used for? Maybe it's being used to try and evade sanctions for nuclear proliferation or for something else entirely. So we've gone from having a really, if I look back to starting my career, where you had criminals in one box, terrorists in another, nation state in another, those hybrid threats, that blended threat and that skill set sits across everything now. And there's the core premise of the UN now. We have a thing called our Sustainable Development Agenda, which is by 2030 aiming to do lots of different things around the world to basically make the world more sustainable. And if I look across some of those big topic areas in these goals, there's 17 goals, we look at good health and well-being, you look at gender equality, you look at clean water, you look at decent economic growth, you look at sustainable cities, you look at peace and justice institutions, all of these things can be undermined by a cyber attack.
Yeah, yep.
It's not simply crime. It's you take an MRI scanner offline, hospital goes down. You take a bank offline, you look at the attack on the Bangladesh Bank last year, significant financial loss that was nearly even bigger. You start to see the impact that can have on the stability of an economy. You look at all the positives that cryptocurrencies bring in bringing the ability to move finance to communities that don't have it, but then turning it on its head, it's making the movement of illicit finance and terrorist finance much, much easier. And it's also the potential, because it doesn't generate tax, that it could actually do more harm than good in some communities.
Yeah, exactly. How do you pay for the roads, schools, hospitals, etc.? And this is, for the libertarians out there who would, who would invest and use virtual currencies and kind of push the way society, etc. Very mixed feelings about the kind of intent there or the thought process, because often these people have been well educated and leveraged a lot of the infrastructure that was paid for by taxes, by society. So
life is not ironic. Even Alanis Morissette would go for it.
Exactly. Exactly.
It came to my mind really, really strongly last year. I was lucky enough to speak with and brief the Pope on the work that we're doing. And prior to meeting the Pope, there was a conference on, again, this was on the child sexual exploitation side. There was a privacy activist who comes from a part of the world where online privacy is really challenged and really difficult to manage. But listening to her sense of things that, yes, I understand that seeing children horribly abused online is horrendous, but that's the price we pay for privacy. That really shocked me because I'm not quite sure I agree with it to that extent. Mm. And then bringing it to the other side of saying, well, we must control everything to manage risk, full stop. I don't agree with that either.
Yeah.
And my sense of things here is that there is no one size fits all, Nick. There is, this all depends on the political democracy that you live in and what democracy looks like and feels like and how society works in a country, in a region and internationally. But fundamentally, this all comes back to we are all living a life wherever we are, trying to get on with life and trying to minimize risk and harm to ourselves, to our children. And
we need to learn to undulate in the sea of zeros and ones in a gray area, not on the extreme side of things.
Absolutely. And just thinking through risk before it happens, right? And this is for any of you who are listening to this who are involved in tech development. We're not saying don't do it. Far from it. You know, I'm part of a group now that advises the Secretary General on new technology and innovation. So there's so much good coming out of this. But we need people to think about some of the risk around it as well and how to manage that risk. So well, like you said...
Sorry, what's that in tech development from the beginning or...
Yeah, so it's thinking through what is that corporate ethical business model of you're designing the coolest new thing, whatever it may be. Could that be leveraged for bad? If it can, is there something you can do to prevent that?
Yeah.
Right? It's back to the IoT thing again of here's 10,000 great cameras that only cost you $2. Oh, by the way, they've just been hijacked to form a botnet.
Mm. Yeah. Now, look, we are marching on in the time, and it's been an absolutely fascinating discussion. I would like to cover one last area briefly, and that's the United Nations, you know, specifically your area within the United Nations. I, back in the days of living in some other emerging markets, I've contracted to the United Nations for different bits and pieces. And there are always mixed feelings about UN. You get a huge amount of people who go there, and incredibly rich environment, and intellectual and smart and motivated environment. And some of the objections are that people get hampered down by the bureaucracy, and it's very difficult to get things achieved. How have you felt coming from policing and from maybe on the surface, slightly more, action-oriented types of areas into the United Nations? Are you positive, negative? Are you seeing change? Are you affecting change?
Well, there's the career-limiting questions. thanks for that, Nick.
We'll play this in 2 years or something
I'm fundamentally positive by design, but with a healthy dose of scepticism and realism around it as well. And I think this is where I'm really lucky that because of the previous career, so 15 years of seeing what was generally the worst side of human life, that builds a certain psychological resilience. And I was very, very lucky as well to be, I had some really good mentors in policing as I went through that. And one of the last people that I worked for before moving overseas was a director of covert operations. And his best career advice I ever got, which was surround yourself by people who think differently from you and who are smarter than you. Now, finding people who are smarter than me, that is not difficult. And within the UN, there are lots of people who think differently from me, and it's great because it really challenges some of the ideas that I might come up with or a decision that I'm about to make or I have made. But also, I think because of the pressure of the previous life where I would be making life and death decisions that if I get it wrong, someone might die or a group of people might die.
Yeah.
That then, when you come into an organization like this, which is an incredible bureaucracy in ways that I could never have imagined, it gives one the trust in oneself to make a decision and move forward. You know, I often say to my staff, it's easier to seek forgiveness than permission. So it's trying to look at what are we doing, everything that we do, and this is across the UN, and I'm really glad that we have a Secretary General who empowers us to do this. It's really about crack on and get things done. It's not about keep sticking things through a committee, keep asking permission from somebody else. Take the decision, move forward, do something. And everything we do is about having impact that does something in people's lives. And the work that my staff around the world, in Guatemala, in El Salvador, in Tunisia, in Nairobi, in Bangkok, they are all doing stuff that we can measure, fundamentally measure, has saved lives this year. We've helped the countries that we're working with to prevent some element of crime or terrorism.
Now, when you say you've helped, is it more empowerment of the law enforcement agencies in those specific countries, or you actually feet on the ground getting your deads out?
We're trainees. We're not a law enforcement body. We're not an intelligence body. We are purely diplomats. Okay. But our focus is capacity building. So helping cops, prosecutors and judges to grow a skill set in an area. So my part of the world is cybercrime, terrorist financing and anti-money laundering.
Yep.
And what we do is we have a mentorship based approach. So the majority of my staff have come from a law enforcement, military, intelligence background or legal background. So they've been there and they've done it. And like lots of things in life, you can help people to learn from the mistakes that you've personally made in the past, that I've personally made in the past, help to grow from that. And the partnerships that we have with industry, we do work with people like Facebook, like Google, like Microsoft, and with academics and with lots of others to help grow that skill set in countering a threat. And then we do a lot of work now in prevention. So we go into schools, we've got a thing called our Education for Justice initiative, which is basically getting into kids at the earliest of ages, explaining what online risk looks like and helping kids to make better critical thinking based decisions to manage their risk right the way from the earliest of ages of 3-4 all the way through their life cycle. And if apply this to what is cybersecurity, what is personal security, what is national security. If you embed this into children at the earliest of ages, they make good, sound, critical thinking, ethical-based decisions. They become better at whatever they're going to go on to do.
Yeah.
And that fundamentally makes society better.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm just reminded of when I was in Guatemala, I had a gun to my head. So that, people it is, but I think it's about 14% of people who are a-holes, and the rest just want to live a good life.
it's the challenge where, you know, and I'm not in Guatemala, but certainly in a different place, I've been on that wrong end of a weapon, and that's one of those moments where you think, this is a bad day out.
Yeah.
And it's one of those things where those sorts of experiences stick with you, and
absolutely.
How do you react to it? Do you do something positive with it and say, right, I'm going to do something in my life that makes a bloody difference here. I'm not going to sit back and just say, yeah, shit happens sometimes and I can't fix it. Yeah. We all have to step up to this. There is no one person, no one organization, no one government that has the solution to this. But if we fundamentally focus on what's important and how we live and work together to keep our lives as secure as we can, recognizing that lots of the bits of the world where we work, life is bloody tough for people. So if we can do something that helps to manage that risk down and keep people a little bit safer, then it's been worth it.
Well, Neil, I think that's probably a good point to wrap up what has been an absolutely incredible discussion and such a rich and interesting and intriguing and impressive background that you've got. So thank you so much. It's been an absolute privilege. If you're ever in Milan, or if I remember in Vienna, I'm sure we'll be able to sit down over a coffee and get stuck into more topics. But look, that's
it. It would be a pleasure, and I want to take the chance to say thank you to you, because things like this podcast make a difference. You know, there has never been a more important time in the world to have good journalism, good visibility of what's genuinely going on in the world. When there is so much fake news around, so much misperception and so much nuance that's being lost, having a conversation about what real life actually is so important. So thank you for giving us the opportunity to do this.
My pleasure. No worries. And thank you. Thank you, listeners, too, because obviously you guys have to, you guys who are listening to this are also part of the Empowered. So Thank you, everybody. Thanks, Neil, and look forward to the next episode. Cheers for that.
Welcome to our podcast at agendadigitale.eu.